It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valeni, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch, from the best bets to the sneaky underdogs. And of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Rick Wolf's Sports Edge. I'm your host, Rick Wolf. Well, we're in the middle of July. It's the heart of summertime. And to that end, I thought we'd have a little fun on this morning's show. You know, we've been through a lot over the last several months, and we've had to cover and discuss a number of issues and topics that, quite honestly, haven't been a lot of fun to talk about. So, allow me to do something of a sort of a reset on the Sports Edge. Yes, of course, troubling and worrisome topics happen in youth and amateur sports. And as all sports parents and coaches who are eager to see our coaches or see our kids learn and to master athletics, we want, above everything else, to see them grow through their sports activities. We want them to learn about building self-confidence, about becoming a dependable teammate, about learning to respect their opponents, to understand that there is no guarantee about winning or losing, and that the very best way to fight through pregame nervousness is to be as best prepared as you can be. And if today is not your day to win, well, so be it. Losing is going to sting. But for the best and the smartest young athletes, they learn from their losses in the hope that they can improve upon their weaknesses in order to get better. I mean, look, that's what life is all about. And as sports parents, we really do hope that our kids learn those life lessons. In the meantime, we want them to enjoy themselves playing sports, to have a smile on their face, and in short, to, yes, and I keep coming back to this, to have fun. Because if your kids have fun playing sports, friends, trust me, you will have fun as well. Okay, that's my Sunday sermon for this morning. Let's get on to the rest of the show. Hopefully you will have some excellent topics to cover. Now, I'm planning on talking with two of my favorite people when it comes to issues in sports, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy hearing what they have to say. And first up, I'm going to be talking with New Jersey Hall of Fame coach Jack Smithlin. Those of you who listen to my show on a regular basis know that Jack has become something of a weekly staple on the program. But on this morning's Sports Edge, rather than my waiting for Jack to call in, today we're going to call him and interview Jack in his role as a college coach and his insights on the world of sports psychology. And in particular, I really want to focus with Jack on the jump from high school sports to playing at the collegiate level. I always talk about that jump, that for most athletes, it's more than just a natural or normal next step up the ladder. And quite frankly, it's more of a giant leap to the next level. And for many freshmen, well, it can be a difficult adjustment. Then later on in the hour, I'm going to welcome back the original boy of summer, Massapequa's own Rob Nelson. Rob was a top pitcher who went from junior college till Cornell, where he was an all-Ivy left-handed pitcher. But when he graduated from school, well, he came up with the idea of Big League Chew. I got to tell you, I love hearing Nelly tell his unique and fun story of becoming a highly successful bubblegum magnate, of how he and his business partner Jim Boughton invented Big League Chew. And along the way, Nelly has a new spin on the infield fly rule. He's also invented clockwise baseball, which I want to share with you, and get his basic thoughts on the game of baseball today. He's a lot of fun. Okay, so sit back and relax. This is going to be a real treat today, and let's start our conversation with Jack Smithlin. Now, as noted, if you happen to be a regular listener to the Sports Edge, you know that one of my favorite callers each Sunday is Jack. You also know that Jack has served as a highly successful high school coach for more than 40 years over in New Jersey. He and his wife, Sue, who is also a superb coach as well, they have two sons, Zach and Alex, who are both terrific Division I athletes. But, Jack, good morning. It's good to talk to you.
How are you, Rick? You know, I loved your intro as always. And real quick, I have a saying about, you know, some days you win and some days you lose. Well, my saying is some days you win and some days you learn.
Yeah.
You know, by learning from our mistakes. So, yeah, I just wanted to add that in because that was a great intro you just did.
Well, I'm glad. And I go, and we'll touch on in a few minutes, you have one of the world's most extensive libraries of sports psychology books. Yeah. We'll talk about that. But, you know, after coaching in high school for so long, and then you mentioned on to coach over at softball at Montclair State, and now you're over at New Jersey City University, where along with head coach Ashley Martinez, you guys are quietly putting together what's going to be a top-notch program. But I do know that over the course of the last few months, you know, you wrote a sort of a, you were invited to write some chapters in a manual for incoming athletes at the college level. And you made, in our discussions, you made a point, which I wanted to share with the audience this morning, about that transition, Jack, from high school to college. Because that's a psychological concern that's not often discussed. You know, let's put it this way. When you look at a typical college roster, it doesn't make any difference where it's Division I, Division II, Division III, but pretty much every kid on that roster, on that college team, was a big star in their high school. Everybody had great stats. Everybody made All-League or All-County. Everybody was an All-Star, and so on. Or they were top players on their travel and club team as well. So now you get from high school to college, well, it gets a little tougher to become a standout athlete. You're chuckling because you know where I'm going with this. For a lot of freshmen in particular, you know, all of a sudden they're surrounded on a college campus, you know, at the athletic fields, and they say, oh, my gosh, I'm surrounded by people who really are top athletes just like myself. And climbing that pyramid of competition gets a lot steeper for these new college kids. And for kids who are youngsters who've always had great success in their sport, Jack, as you well know, this can be a most unsettling experience. So if you would, let's talk about this phenomenon and you know, what you've seen, what you observed as a college coach when these kids who were stars in high school now make that jump to college.
Well, you know, you referred to my two sons, and real quick to start this little segment off, it's a pretty good story. I remember when Zach was playing at Penn State as a freshman, we were invited out there for a family day, which was one of their scrimmages in the fall. Mm-hmm. And when we got out there and sat in the stands, Sue looked at me and she said, "Oh my God, these are men." And I said, "You're absolutely right. I mean, some of these guys can be 24 years old, and here's our 17-year-old, you know, 160-pound wet noodle, competing against these, you know." And you're absolutely right. The transition is a very, very tough transition. You know, I wrote that little blurb. It was kind of an intro to that catalog that we're putting together. And the first part I called Head Games, and you know, it talked about, you know, psychologists, you know, referring to those 6 to 8 inches between your ears. Well, they're talking about the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I said was this, is that, you know, the transition from high school, you know, it's not a continuation of high school ball. You know, all those kids that you're going to be playing against now were those best kids on all the other teams you played in high school. And even when batting, even when getting up to the plate, you know, the pitchers that you're going to be facing, oh, there's two or three pitchers that you went 0-for-30 against in your 4 years against them, but you still batted .480 during the season. Those are the kind of pitchers you're going to see every single day.
Let me just stop that, because I think that's the point that I think a lot of kids and their parents don't understand. That, sure, okay, you were a top-notch athlete in high school playing softball or baseball, whatever sport may be, and you hit, you know, .480, as you said. But against some of the best pitchers you faced, you may have gone 1-for-8 with several strikeouts because they were the premier pitchers. All the other pitchers you faced, you hit well and hit over .500. But for the couple that were really outstanding, those are the kind of kids you're going to see on a regular, routine, everyday basis in college. And I think that's where I think a lot of the youngsters, the freshmen, sort of get, whoa, what have I signed up for? And that's where I'm asking, you know, as a college coach, how do you get with these kids? How do you convince them that they're going to be okay?
Well, you know what? You let them come into fall ball, and you let them compete every day against these juniors and seniors, and you let them see the difference. You know those all the accolades they got in high school, all state, all county, all conference, that was against high school kids. And you got to remember this. Less than 4% of those kids you played against are ever going to play at the college level. So you're talking about 96% of the kids that you played against will never make it at the level that you're going to right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you think about that, you're playing against good competition. And not only do you have to improve on your skill level, and that's something that we work on every single day at New Jersey City University, but you also have to gain, you know, confidence. You have to work on your head game. You got to get bigger and stronger. Also, you know, it's not just like in high school where you March 2nd came along and, you know, and you played your 8 to 9 weeks of the season and the season was over. And then you went on to your other sports or club ball. Here, you're lifting all year. You know, you're playing all year. You're playing in the fall. When you come back from break, you start immediately and you play every day until the end of the season in May. And, you know, you're looking at it, it's a full-time job. It's not an easy thing to transition to because, you know, the one thing that helps us, though, Rick, really, are these kids who are playing club ball. And those kids that are playing every day, practicing, you know, even though I don't agree with that, they're getting better and bigger, and hopefully they don't burn out someday. But, you know, they're the ones that come to the college level and they compete and they work out and they, you know, and, you know, there's a rude awakening happening at New Jersey City University. We brought in a really good recruiting program. I recruited a bunch of good kids this year, and they're going to compete right away for positions. It's not like they're going to have to work their way up the ladder. These kids are ready. They're competitive and they're ready to go. And, you know, some of our players are going to have a rude awakening because they're going to have to compete right away with these freshmen because these kids, they understand what that transition is. But
yeah,
as a coach,
yeah,
it's a tough thing, Rick. Go ahead.
Well, as I say, and friends, we're talking, of course, with Jack Smithlin. We're talking about the psychological jump from high school to college to play college sports. And to your point, Jack, it works sort of both ways. If you're an incoming freshman, yeah, probably you've been exposed to outstanding competition in the summer leagues or in the, you know, travel or club situation, but still, now you're surrounded by all your teammates. Yep. They're all really, really good, and you may have been a star in your local high school program, but now you're, in a sense, playing in the quote-unquote collegiate big leagues. And at the same time, if you're a returning junior or senior, you might say, well, geez, some of these kids that are on the team now, these incoming freshmen, some of them look like have some real talent. So I know as a coach myself, and, you know, it was always difficult to watch these kids struggle during the fall because, you know, that's the certainly to me the fall time for baseball and in your case with softball, those were critical times to make sure everybody sort of, you know, checked out, you know, their competition, saw what they could do, what they couldn't do, and what they're going to do in terms of making a commitment. As you said, Jack, you know, if you're playing Division III sports, Division I sports at college, I think a lot of kids have to understand this is sort of a full-year commitment. This is not like you play on a seasonal basis you did in high school, but when you play a sport in college, it's a pretty much of a full-time job while you're going to school, and in many cases, kids obviously have part-time jobs as well. It's tricky.
It's a full-time job, Rick. It really is. And, you know, one of the things, you know, the old saying, the old cliche, you know, in high school, you're a big fish in a small pond. You get to the college level, now you're a small fish in a big pond.
Correct.
And, you know, and now you're competing against kids that are better than you, not as good or even less skillful than you are. Now they're all your level and better. So now you got to pick up your game a little bit. You got to start understanding that, you know, it's not just playing seasonal anymore. It's not just training, you know, one night a week all year long, which is my theory of, you know, of training all year, playing all year. It's training all year. You know, you got to be ready for this. And as a coach, it's a big difference too. You know, I coached in the fall back years ago. We weren't allowed to practice during the season. We weren't allowed to practice in the summer with our teams. So, you know, we had breaks or we coached other sports, which I did. I coached three sports for almost 40 years. But the point is that now we're allowed to practice in the summer in high school, you know, so that's a little bit of an edge. But once the school season starts, your high school coach is off limits to you. So here you are, you know, you wait for the March, you play March, April, and May, and the season's over, and you're okay. At college, you're coming, you're playing in the summer, you're working out, lifting in the summer, you're playing in the fall, you come back in the winter, and you go right from the, as soon as you get back from winter break, all the way through to the end of the season.
Well, it might, as I say,
it's a tough job.
It is a tough job, and it really sort of questions or challenges the student-athlete as they come into a collegiate program, and it just, are you aware for this kind of commitment? And that's where I think the whole world of sports psychology comes into play, Jack, because this is where the kid is obviously in a new environment, new friends, new teammates, new coaches. You know, all of a sudden, it gets you sort of feel a little small, and suddenly you have to sort of figure out, well, the coach is saying basically this is how we practice, this is our routine in the fall, this is what we do in the winter, this is what we do in the spring. What about classes? I mean, it's something where you have to sort of figure out how important is this to you? Because a lot of kids decide, and which is fine, that I was very happy with my high school career, I was very successful, but I don't want to make the commitment to play at the collegiate level. And quite frankly, I'm not sure I'm even good enough to play at the collegiate level. And this is where the coaches have to be sensitive as to what's going through the kid's head. There's a kid, you might, you know, Jack, there might be a situation where a kid, you look at a kid and say, this kid's got some real potential, and you like the fact that she's on the softball team in the fall, but the kid's thinking, I'm over my head, I'm not going to be able to cut and make the starting lineup here.
Your situation is, you know, when you talk about the percentages, think about this, and this is the way I look at it, and this is the way I present it to my players, even my high school players. In high school, you're playing against those 96%
yes.
that never make it, you know? In college, you're playing against all those 4% that did. So, you know, it's a big difference. It's a big adjustment, Rick. Huge.
It is, and again, it's not that, look, for let's face it, to put it in perspective, making a high school varsity team is a big deal for everybody. Yep. But again, now we're talking about the elite of the elite going on to play at the collegiate level, and it's difficult. I mean, you and I are on the same page in terms of tryouts or kids who walk on to play in the fall. You know, I would always let my kids, you know, try out for several days. So not only could I get a sense of what, you know, they could do on the field, but also to get let them have a sense of who they're competing against, to see that the you know the pitchers have a little more giddy up on their fastball, or they throw a better curve, or the hitters have more power or more speed in terms of the base paths. But it's a two-way street. But you want to make sure if the kid decides to, you know, thank you for the opportunity, I think I'm just going to focus on my studies and go on a different direction. You want them to feel as though they are absolutely sure in their mind that this is not the right path for them in terms of the other team. And the other kids are going to say, Coach, I really want to be on this team. What do I need to do to get better? And as you mentioned about, you know, competition and trying to find a way, that's where the psychology comes of trying to figure out how can I figure out how I can be more consistent or do things better.
Your edge is your head. And it really is. I mean, when you get to that level, you know, the difference between the great players and the not-so-great players is in their head. Are those 6 to 8 inches between your ears?
Yep.
And that's exactly the topic that I wrote about. You know, I called it the head game. You know, you got to understand psychology. And Rick, you've written, you know, you talked about books before. You've written a fabulous book on sports psychology, you know, and I had a bunch of them. I read over 100 books on the mental game.
Yes.
And I just keep reading. I mean, I order one, you know, 2 weeks before I'm finishing with the next one. So it's a big part of the game, and you better adjust to it. You better understand it.
I couldn't agree more, and as I said, you and I are on the same wavelength in terms of sports psychology. I'm not surprised, we've discussed this in the past, that you've read, you know, so many of these books in this field. And quite frankly, up until 30 years ago, there was maybe one or two books on sports psychology, so this is a whole new world. And again, if you're an athlete, if your son or daughter is a freshman or going in to play a college sport, as a parent, I would strongly advise to tell your son or daughter if you know, if they feel like they may be a little struggling or overmatched, or they're finding their way, by all means, make sure they go to the coach, to make sure that the coach knows that they're there, they're working hard, they're trying to make the team, because you got to have that positive feedback and that communication from the coaching staff. Otherwise, it's going to be, you're going to feel like you're basically all alone by yourself. And I know this is one of the reasons why we see the transfer portal being so active. We know why so many kids decide that it's not what they want to do, or they walk away from the sport. And the coach sometimes is surprised, because the coach says, well, I thought the kid was making pretty good progress as a freshman. Again, as you said at the outset, you know, when your own boys got to college at Penn State, and suddenly, you know, as your wife Sue said, these kids are competing against real men, and it's a big jump.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, I was shocked too. I mean, you know, but I kind of understood it a little bit, you know. And then I'm going to tell you something, and this is something that also, when we talked about the working out part, you know, and how it's a big transition for high school athletes. Zachary went into Penn State at 160 pounds. He came out at 192 pounds.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm telling you right now, you know, if you think about it, it's less than 10 pounds a year, but it was all muscle weight. You know, it was just, he built it. And then he got drafted, and he played pro ball for 8 years, you know, and then he had to put a wooden bat in his hand. I mean, he played in the Cape Cod League, you know, but there's another transition. But in softball, you don't have that. Your equipment is your equipment, and you play the same equipment from when you're in T-ball all the way up through college. So, you know, the transition is amazing, but the head game part of it is such a big, important part. And like I said before, and I'll say it again, the two best books that I've ever read on the game, on the psychology of sport, was The Mental Game of Baseball by H.A. Dorfman and Carl Fuhl.
Right.
And your book, The Secrets of Sports Psychology Revealed.
Well,
and the reason I like your book, it was because it was, in layman's terms, very easy to read and very easy to understand.
Jack, I'm afraid I'm out of time, but I'm so glad you mentioned the Dorfman-Kiel book, which has become, of course, a classic for all top high school, college, and professional baseball players, The Mental Game of Baseball, and thank you for the kind words about The Secrets of Sports Psychology Revealed.
It's a gold mine, people. It's a gold mine. Really read it.
If you're a sports parent and you got a kid who wants to play sports someday in college, I strongly urge you to pick up a copy of those books or any other book about sports psychology that talks about this kind of transition, this major jump from high school to college. Hey, Jack Smith, always a pleasure to talk to you. Obviously, we'll talk to you again next Sunday on the show, but my thanks for coming on this morning to talk about this critically important aspect of the transition from high school to college.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thanks, Jack. Talk to you soon.
What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valeni and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, back here on the Sports Edge, everyone. And I have to tell you, it always gives me a great pleasure to bring back my old teammate, Rob Nelson, to the show. Now, Nelson, or Nelly as he's known, is one of those individuals who was born to be a baseball pitcher, and a left-handed pitcher in particular. And he's the co-inventor of Big League Chew, which has thrilled generations of young ballplayers for years. Indeed, the bubblegum Big League Chew has become so ingrained with baseball, it's actually difficult to think of a time when Big League Chew didn't really exist. And Nelly, that's hard to believe, because every kid today all knows about Big League Chew. But let's start with this unusual story of how you came up with the idea for the gum, and how you and your then teammate in the Portland Mavericks, Jim Boughton, started on this pathway to make the gum into a household name.
It's a preposterous story, and you know, I know we don't have that much time, but I went from being a middle school teacher in Cape Town, South Africa, and pitching, just having the time of my life in Cape Town, I read an article about the Portland Mavericks that my dad had sent me. And the next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Portland, Oregon, and trying out for the Portland Maverick Baseball Club. I ended up making the team, but just marginally. And I was there for three seasons and had one win in 3 years. So my brothers are still trying to figure out how I pitched briefly and ineffectively for a thousand days.
Yeah, but, you know,
I don't understand it either.
Well, you're being, Nelly, you're being too modest. Remember, you are from, you're one of Long Island's own. You're the pride and joy of Massapequa. And you, would you go to Nassau Community College first before you went to Cornell?
Well, you know, it's a crazy, I mean, it was like an odyssey, really, because I started at Marietta College. I mean, I was all Nassau County in 1967. One team recruited me, a D3 great program, Marietta College.
Yes.
And it's a funny thing. You know, it's a funny thing when a college coach says, Rob, I'm really glad you're coming here. We need left-handed pitching. And you show up and you find out he said the same thing to eight other left-handers. So I lasted 1 year there. You know, as my dad would say, my dad was NYPD. When Coach Don Shalley told me that, he said that, you know, if you parse the words, he said, I'm glad you're coming here. I really need left-handed pitching. My dad would say, well, he won't get indicted with that response. You know, and that was true. He did need left-handed pitching. He just didn't need me. So I went from NASA. The highlight of that for me at NASA at Marietta was I became friends with Kent Tekulve, who had a great career in the big leagues.
Sure, of course.
And I got to pitch effectively, as it turns out, against Mike Schmidt, who was at Ohio University at the time. And it's like the story of my life. I pitched against Mike Schmidt before he learned how to hit. And he said so in his biography. He didn't learn to hit, really, until he was a junior in college. So we were freshmen. So that's the name of that tune. Well, but, yeah, Tekulve had, what, 20 years in the big leagues? He was a wonderful guy. And as you and I both know, we were just talking about it recently, we've been friends for over 50 years. The joy of baseball is largely in the guys you play with, the opponents, and the teammates that you've had, and all the coaches we've had over the years, guys like Al Goldis, who just have a heart as big as the world, and that we all have this passion for the game of baseball. So getting back to Big League Chew, the passion takes me to Cape Town, takes me to Portland, Oregon. I'm sitting in the dugout, the bullpen, rather, which I did a lot of with the Mavericks, and Jim Bouton and I are looking at our teammates making fools of themselves, chewing the other stuff, the brown stuff, and dribbling it on their uniforms and on their shoes. And Jim had said, have you ever tried a redneck? And I said, you know, I tried it once. I remember where I was. It was a horrific experience. I couldn't throw batting practice that day because my head just spun out of control. I said, it never made sense to me. And Jim said, same thing. And so an inning or two later, I said, suppose we shredded bubblegum, put it in a pouch, and we would look cool and we wouldn't make ourselves ill. And Jim's eyes got as big as baseballs. And being the businessman that he was, I mean, he pitched for the Yankees, he pitched in the World Series, he wrote Ball 4, he was a TV sportscaster, you know, he's a star in a movie, The Long Goodbye. He's a real Renaissance man, but the first thing he said was two things. He said, Rob, I love that idea. And number two, I could sell that idea. So that was the key thing. I'm kind of the surfer dude out there playing baseball. My dad said I was the baseball equivalent of a ski bum, and he's not far from the truth there. But Jim, he was a dreamer with a deadline, and that's why we became such great partners. He used to say Rob had the inspiration and he was the perspiration. And that's the truth. I had the idea. Jim had the wherewithal and the tenacity to go out and pitch it to 8 or 9 different companies saying, we got shredded gum, comes in a bag. It's a pretty cool idea.
Well, let me just stop you there and sort of frame this for our listeners. This is all taking place in the mid to late 70s. I mean, you're being modest, but obviously after when you got to Cornell, and yes, you were a control specialist left-hander with an unbelievable move to first base. You were cut from the same cloth as, let's say, Jamie Moyer in terms of changing speeds on batters, these days, that's totally anathema if you're trying to get to the big leagues because they'll want to see you throw 90-plus miles an hour. But in those days, you were effective in college. You were all Ivy at Cornell, and you end up, as you said, in with the Portland Mavericks, this one of the original independent teams. And Jim Bouton, who had already had a great career as a pitcher in the bigs, and obviously was the author of Ball 4, which changed the whole world of sports books, but Bouton was trying to make a comeback as a knuckleball pitcher. And here you are in this bullpen in Portland, Oregon, and you guys come up with this idea for putting strips of pink bubble gum in an aluminum pouch, and boom, you're off and running. And Jim sells this, I guess, to Wrigley, the gum manufacturer, and then you have this. I mean, basically, you're now living off the royalties from your gum, and you decided to go back and just play baseball. Is that correct?
Well, that's exactly right. I got to coach kids. The reason I could go overseas was, number one, I picked countries where baseball wasn't a big deal. It was kind of like when I pitched in England. It's like rugby over here. Guys play for the love of the game. So I was, like, for a team over there, a dream come true, I didn't want anything. Give me a pint of Guinness after every game on Sunday, and I'll coach your kids, and all I want is 9 innings every Sunday if I can go that far. So I did that in Australia. I did that in England. I went back to South Africa. I did it for about 15 years. But all the while, I still have my teaching Jones in my system. So I coached a lot of kids and had a whole lot of fun doing it. And, you know, the holidays are great when I'm getting cards from all over the world. And I've said it time and again, there's been no lefty luckier than I. I mean, I don't know if I probably broke 80 when I was in my 20s. And now I'm you know, with my kids camp, I'm using the kilometer gun just so I can get into double digits, you know. So I have not been cheated. I say that to my kids all the time, that, you know, when I had to finally give up my Southampton baseball school after 35 years, my elbow just couldn't take it. And I wanted to keep playing tennis, but, you know, I wanted to walk off the field. My son, Charlie, said, you know, it's better to be vertical when you finish the camp, Dad, than having them carry you off in a stretcher. I said, that's a very good way of putting it, Charlie. So, yeah, as you well know, better than most of my friends, I've led the league in fun. And that's where Big League Chew came from. That's why Jim Bouton was such a great ambassador for Big League Chew. When we went to this small division of Wrigley, Amaral Confections, at the time they were making things like Ouch Bubblegum that looked like a Band-Aid. And you know, we come along with Big League Chew. Even the Wrigley experts didn't know. We had a 3-year contract. They thought, nice novelty. We'll introduce it. We'll make a killing in a year or two and sell their inventory off in year 3. And after year 1, when they sold $18 million worth of gum, we redid the deal for long term. And that was awesome. Mars bought out Wrigley about 12 years ago. So I had to find a smaller company that was more nimble to handle such a niche brand like Big League Chew. As luck would have it, Ford Gum is in Western New York. It just fit perfectly. I mean, I was a Massapequa guy, Nassau Community College, Cornell. My brothers are all New York educated. And then to go to Western New York, I had so many teammates from the Buffalo area. And you're going to think it's weird as a businessman, but the two things clinched it for me to go to Ford Gum. Number one, Warren Spahn grew up there. One of the greatest left-handers of all time.
Of course.
And they filmed The Natural there.
Yes.
So for those two reasons alone, that's why the gum should be made in Buffalo, New York. And we're 3 hours from Cooperstown, which is how we ended up becoming the official bubble gum of the Baseball Hall of Fame. As my brother Ed says, well, your gum's in the hall, but not your arm. So you take what you can, you know?
Yeah, but you mentioned you pitched against Mike Schmidt before he learned to hit in college ball. Mike Schmidt got there in 95 to the Hall of Fame, so I'm glad to hear at least your gum got there, if not your arm, so...
Yeah, so one thing I have in common with Mike Schmidt, that's pretty funny.
Well, it's a wonderful story. Now, during this time, when you're obviously going around the world playing baseball, trying to, you know, I guess there are a lot of ball players in Australia where you played for years, or in the UK, places like that, they had probably never seen the kind of curveball and change of speed. So I guess you dominate over there during that time?
You know, I had a really good time for the reasons you're talking about. I was a lefty. I worked the plate. You know, I've said time and again, most recently, I said if Whitey Ford were at an open tryout today, he wouldn't get signed. And I was lucky. Again, timing is everything. Where everybody is trying to pump up, I'm just working at changing speeds. And to me, the ultimate pitch was the ground ball double play.
Right.
And you know, the intangible things are kind of going away with the saber metrics. You know, I don't know any scout that says how good is his move to first base. But I can't tell you how many times it just saved me over the years to have something a little bit extra, another trick up my sleeve that kept me going. And I got to say, it's a delight to lead the league in fun no matter where you are. So when I met Bing Russell out here in Portland, Oregon, the fellow who owned the team, I mean, here's a guy who went to Dartmouth, ends up being the deputy sheriff on Bonanza, the TV series. He's the father of Kurt Russell, who was, you know, an idol of mine. And I'm sitting in the dugout with Mr. Russell and his son, Kurt, and I can't believe it. It's just so much fun. So all I can say for, you know, your listeners out there, if you're 11 or 12 years old and you love baseball, just keep playing and find a way to stay in the game. I mean, when I came out here to Portland, I didn't make the team. I had a thing already. I asked Bing Russell, can I use some of your players in the mornings? I'd like to start the Little Maverick Baseball School. And he was all over it. I was in Portland for 14 days, and I had an up-and-running baseball day camp. That I mean, John Jaha, the only big leaguer who made it from the Little Maverick camp, was in there the first year. And the funny thing was, I'd said to Bing Russell, I said, you know, one of the kids in the camp is going to make it to the big leagues before any one of us are going to make it. And he laughed at that thing, but I was right. It was pretty crazy.
Well, yeah.
The whole thing came from the heart of the game that I loved being around the game. And I thank my brother Harry, who was a minor leaguer with the Yankees, my dad, who loved the game. And frankly, even though I was a big Mets fan, I got to thank Whitey Ford. I mean, my license plate out here in Portland is 1-6 in honor of Whitey Ford. I mean, and so is the helmet number on the original Big League Chew guy. I mean, the cool thing about going to the Hall of Fame and pitching it that we should be your bubblegum was all the esoterica that I knew about the game. Jeff Idelson, the president at the time, he realized this isn't a bubblegum guy. This is a baseball guy.
Of course,
and
of course.
That's why it fit, you know?
Well, I mean, look, and by the way, just as a postscript, I remember you talking about having that great move, a pickoff move to first base. I can vividly recall sitting in the clubhouse when I was on the Harvard baseball team, and we were going to play Cornell, and our coach said, does anybody know this guy, Rob Nelson, the left-hander from Cornell? And I said, yeah, he's a teammate of me in the summer leagues in the ACBL. He said, what should we know about him? I said to him, well, more things you know about him is he's got an unbelievable sequence of moves to first base, so be careful. He will definitely pick off somebody during the course of the game. And of course, everybody sort of laughed at me and so on and so forth. And sure enough, you picked off like the first guy. They got the first off you. So anyhow, but going back to this love of baseball and the passion that obviously you've had, and I've had, and so many other millions of people in our generation have had for the game, you have to be, look what's happening with baseball over the last 4 or 5, you know, 10 years now, Nelly, and the analytics and the concerns about all the strikeouts and all the power pitching. And the shifts, what is your sense of this, and how is this? You must consider this as being sort of a bad trend in terms of the game of popularity, the game's popularity in terms of the next generation of ballplayers.
You know, it's interesting in terms of the trends and the way the game is played. When Bob Gibson dominated baseball in 1968, They lowered the mound. I think they probably deadened the ball or livened the ball. I don't know. They made adjustments to make the game more interesting for the fans. And I think that if the pitchers are dominating, I don't have a problem with lowering the mound. I don't have a problem with deadening the baseball. I do have an issue putting fake runners on second base in the 10th inning And getting rid of the shift and stuff like that. The game will endure. The hitters will catch up to the pitchers. But if it turns out the pitching distance should be halfway between home and second base, there's kind of a mathematical elegance to that. So if a guy has to throw it 62 feet or whatever it is to make the game more fun and more interesting, I think that's what they should do. Very few people remember it was the owner of the Syracuse Nats, who became the Philadelphia 76ers, who said, you know, our league is dying. We need a shot clock.
I was just going to say, yeah.
That's Those things happen all the time. You know, you look at how many rule changes happen in the NFL every year, protecting the quarterback, doing various things. If baseball just leaves the game alone, if you look at old footage of Tom Seaver pitching or Koufax or Whitey Ford, the games move along. So baseball's got to make a decision here that do you want the breaks in between innings to be longer so you can sell more tires or whatever it is you're trying to sell? That's a big part of it. To change the game, to me, doesn't make sense. If you look at Bob Gibson's games, he didn't need a shot clock. Every 16 or 18 seconds, the ball was on the batter.
But
let's
talk about that for a second, because yeah, these are obviously Hall of Fame pitchers who knew what they were going to throw, and they didn't have to get the ball back from the catcher, and they're ready to go. They've already figured out how they're going to pitch to that batter. They're obviously, as you know, they're having tremendous response to this 14-second pitch count in the minor leagues, and it's pretty clear that that's going to be adopted next year in the big leagues, that every pitcher has 14 seconds to make their mixed pitch. It's already shaving 20 minutes off the games in the minors. But again, as you just alluded to, there was a time where basketball didn't have a shot clock. And they made changes. They said, we got the shot clock. Otherwise, these games are getting very tedious and very boring because the team with the ball just holds it and holds it and holds it. So things like these are natural evolutions that take place. And certainly, there was a time, Nelly, when baseball pitchers did get the ball back from the catcher and said, let's go. And, of course, the fielders, it just has a sort of a cascading positive effect. All the fielders are on their toes. The games are faster. You have to take some time between half innings for the TV commercials. I get that. But the rest of the game was sort of sped up. And, of course, this is where we are today. And I think we're finally seeing, some of Major League Baseball and hopefully the owners are paying attention that we have to do something to entice the next generation of younger fans, because otherwise you're going to lose your entire fan base.
There's no question about that, but getting back to the nature of the game itself, it's like playing chess for 3 hours. They have a time limit in chess because if you think of all the possible moves, you increase your chances of winning. And I think not allowing all the – I would eliminate the manager coming out talking to the pitchers. Just go out and play ball. It's supposed to be fun. I think it was Willie Stargell who said that. They don't say work ball at the beginning. They say play ball. And that seems to me to be what is lost with the sabermetric way of looking at the game. If you have unlimited possibilities and everybody's got these note cards and this guy hits there and that guy hits there – I think if you got rid of that stuff and just let guys play, the game would move along. It would be more fun. The NBA with the three-point line, there were a couple of years where they moved it in because they thought that would be prudent, and it turned out not to be the case because guys weren't taking 15-foot jumpers. They were taking 19-foot because they wanted to pick up the extra point. The math dictated that the guys do that. It didn't work out. The NBA made the change. I think baseball can do the same thing. You just keep tweaking things. In terms of the baseball, whether it's the humidor or whatever it is they're doing to the baseballs, there are factors out there that they can play with that can make the game more interesting. Let's face it, they did something to the ball when Babe Ruth started hitting the ball for distance. And it saved the game after the 1919 Black Sox scandal. So I think that to add artificial stuff like banning the shift or putting the Manfred man on second base in the 10th inning, it just doesn't work for me. It's also a different world now. And I think if you played an 11-inning game and it was tied, there's no family there that would say they didn't get their money's worth because the Mets only tied the Phillies. It happens all the time in soccer. Baseball should basically rethink it. Is a tie game that big a deal? And if the game matters at the end of the season, then you have a period where you can make up those games if you need to do that. But I know I've been at the game with my kids at some minor league games before they instituted the runner on second base, and you just really want to get your kids home and to bed. And you've seen a lot of baseball, and of course you want the Hillsboro Hops to win. But if it turns out it's a 4-4 tie, I wouldn't be displeased with that. And I'm guessing most fans would say, you know what, that's not such a bad thing. I don't want to get home at 2 a.m.
Nelly, that's an interesting perspective, and of course it comes from your unbelievably creative and fertile mind. I'm afraid I'm out of time. Obviously, I could talk to you for hours about all this and all the other creative ideas that have percolating in your head, but this is just great, and I'm so thrilled you took a few moments to come on the show this morning. I got to tell you, I mentioned going back to Jim Boughton. I mean, my favorite line of any sports book I've ever read still comes back to the last sentence in Ball 4, in which Boughton wrote, you spend a good deal of your life gripping a baseball, and in the end, it turns out that it was the other way around all the time. And I can't, it certainly applies to Jim Bouton, and it certainly applies to Rob Nelson. Nelly, you're just a treasure to anybody who has a chance to know you. And thank you for all your goodwill and good work in terms of keeping baseball alive and doing good things.
Thanks so much, Rick. This is always a joy. Much appreciated.
That is Rob Nelson, the co-inventor of Big League Chew, which, of course, is a household name everywhere for anybody who knows anything about baseball or just kids who love, you know, bubble gum. And again, it's just a thrill to talk to Rob and to catch up with him. That's going to do it for me in this edition of the Sports Edge. My thanks this morning to Pete Hoffman. Please stick around for Mark Melusis. He's up next, and I'll see you next Sunday right here on the Sports Edge.
It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valeni, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch, from the best bets to the sneaky underdogs. And, of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.